Good morning. Today's Daven Ksivas is Kuf Beis. We're in Kuf Aleph Amud Aleph. We are going to finish Mirat Hashem, the 11th parak of the Masechta, and begin the 12th parak this morning. And also, we are helped with a short daf today. Thank the Lupin Foundation for sponsorship of the daf. Daf is Lurin Zechanish Maslibe Gabriela Bashmuel. And we continue from where we left yesterday. We dealt with a fundamental issue yesterday about the nature of Mion, the nature of Kedusha Katana, something we discussed back in Yevamos, or the Perek of it was described back in, just one Masechta ago, where we talked about where in the event that the father's not there, and either the mother or her brother marrying off, although the marriage does not work on a Torah level, but the Chachamim orchestrated, they legislated such a marriage in order to protect the minor girl. So they incentivize the men to marry her, and this is what's called Kedusha Ketana. One of the rare, if not the only example in the Torah where you could just walk away from a marriage. You cannot, you do not have to give a get. The husband doesn't give her a get. But rather what she does is at 12 years of age, right as she is transitioning from being a Ketana to being a Gedola, so she could say, I'm a Mai, and she refuses her husband. And so and she just walks away. So it only begs the question, what's the nature of the marriage? How exactly do we look at their marriage halachically from the time that he married her to the time where she was memayin? So that is a machlokus between Tanaim, between Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Yehoshua. Rabbi Lazar says that it's really nothing. The marriage is really nothing. He doesn't say what it is. He just simply says what it isn't. It isn't. It doesn't exist. I quoted the Rashi yesterday. Rashi says, Kemafuta ba'alma. It's like pitu. It's not a marriage. And so therefore, none of the benefits of marriage exist in such an institution. It's there just to provide her some sort of food and shelter and some basis of support, but really doesn't, from a marriage standpoint, it doesn't exist. And Rabbi Yehoshua says, no, it's a marriage. It's a marriage with all the financial obligations of a marriage. And the only thing is that it's what makes this unusual is that she can walk away from it. But in fact, it's a marriage. And the Gemara pointed out that this may, in fact, be the machlokas between Rav and Shmuel. The Rav and Shmuel have a debate whether or not she is going to get a ksuva, she's going to forfeit a ksuva. So that is subject to a debate between Rav and Shmuel, and maybe the machlokis between Rav Elazar and Rabbi Yehoshua parallel the machlokis between Rav and Shmuel, but then the Gemara suggested it may not absolutely parallel the machlokis. That's what we got to yesterday. All this is in the context of a Mishnah. In the Mishnah, we talked about three different types of women who do not get a ksuva. The three women who don't get a ksuva is the Mema'enes, Ashnia, and an islandess. So Mema'enes we just described. Mema'enes is somebody who walks away from a marriage, so the Mishnah describes her as not receiving a ksuva. Shnia is a woman who a man married who he should not have married. She is prohibited to him, not through the Torah, but through the Chachamim. Chachma Yisrael added on a layer of women who are prohibited, in addition to the Arayas of the Torah. So the Chachamim, in order to create a siyag, in order to create a fence around the Torah, so they added a number of relatives who you cannot marry, and this is what's called a shnia. A man marries a shnia, so that's a forfeiture of iksuva, meaning the chachamim obviously are going to encourage the two of them to divorce, and when they do, she won't get iksuva. And finally, an islandess. An islandess, a woman who cannot have children, knows that she cannot have children, and does not tell her husband before they get married that she cannot have children, so the Mishnah says that this islandess also is going to be forfeiting her iksuva. Okay, and then the Mishnah points out that not only is there a forfeiture of the iksuva, but then there's also a forfeiture of a number of other things as well. So the Mishnah says, "In laksuva lo peres lo mazonos lo belos." So the Mishnah says a number of things that are not going to be going to her at the conclusion of the of this marriage. We are going to pick it up right where we left off yesterday on kufal afamin al velo belos. One of the things that she will not be receiving is belos. She goes into a marriage. She goes in with clothing. Now this clothing can be structured in one of two ways. We've discussed this already a number of times, but it's one of the basic points within our masechta. The clothing can either go in as nechse melug, which means that the clothing is primarily her, and he's entitled for peros. Now, if you remember earlier what that meant that he could wear the clothing. Okay, I know. All right, I understand. Obviously, so the clothing, we're talking about valuable shit that she brings into the marriage. So I don't think, in other words, we could talk about women's clothing. She could bring in men's clothing. It's clothing. And so so the husband is entitled to wear it. It's that's what we described earlier as the peros of clothing. Stay tuned. In just a little bit in the Gemara, we'll have a dissenting opinion, meaning that what I just said is absolutely accurate in terms of what we learned earlier, but there will be a dissenting opinion in terms of the wearing of clothing falls under the category of peiros. But either way, that's one way that the clothing could be brought into the marriage. Another way the clothing could be brought into the marriage is what's called nechsei tzon barzel. Nechsei tzon barzel, meaning that we at the time of the wedding, the clothing gets appraised. The value of the clothing is written into the ksuva, and so therefore now that clothing goes totally into the domain of the husband. But upon death or divorce, when she collects her ksuva, she's also going to be getting that appraised value as well as part of the settlement at the conclusion of marriage. So the Mishnah says that this woman over here is forfeiting her blows, velo blows. So the Gemara starts off the discussion. So we said the following in the name of Shmuel. So the Gemara now is going to make a distinction in terms of blows. When we said that she's going to be forfeiting her clothing, that's only talking about nechsei malug. But when it comes to nechsei tzaron barzel, that she does have. Okay. That's a statement by Shmuel, obviously making a distinction. Some of the clothing she'll forfeit, and some of it she will not. To which the Gemara now is going to try to clarify this point. Because this point of Shmuel is really difficult to understand, as the Gemara is about to articulate. Havi bar Rav Papa, Rav Papa is discussing this, Ahaya. Now, let's think about this. Shmuel made a distinction, and there are three women to describe being described in our Mishnah. Which one of these three women is Shmuel describing? So let's go step by step. So let's say we're talking about the Mema'enis. So this is a woman who simply walks away with the marriage. Now, she did absolutely nothing wrong. She did what she was perfectly entitled to do. And that is, she can at 12 years of age say, thank you very much for trying, but it's not working, and I'm just going to simply walk away. So, So the Gemara says like this. Think about it now. This is her clothing that she brought into the marriage. Whether it be nechsei tzaron barzel or whether it be nechsei malug. So, if the clothing are there, meaning they weren't worn out, they're still in good shape, so what should she do? She should just simply walk away, and she should take them. They belong to her. Rashi points out, right. There's no reason to penalize her. This is a woman who did absolutely nothing wrong. The clothing, she brought the clothing into the marriage. The clothing's still there. She walks away. Now, the Ida Lesnahu, so now let's say the clothing is not there anymore, meaning they were totally worn out. Okay, and just used. Used to the point where they don't even exist. So then there's nothing for her to take. Rashi points out, when the clothing are not there. So as far as the nechsei tzaron barzel is concerned, so Rashi says, I married her under the auspices of Beis Din. And when I divorce her, then I'll give her what I accepted upon myself through the ksuva. But over here, I didn't divorce her. Over here, she just simply walked away. So that's why he's allowed to retain the nechsei tzaron barzel. What about the nechsei malug? This one's a little trickier, because the nechsei malug is fundamentally hers. So Rashi points out. So the nechsei malug nami. Now Rashi points out that the truth of the matter is that he shouldn't have taken them and he shouldn't have made use of them. But over here with the Nechsei Malug, what he can say is as follows. Look, maybe principally I shouldn't have taken them, but here was the plan. If I was going to divorce her, for sure I would have given it back to her. But remember, this is a marriage. And as such, there is a chance that I may end up with this clothing anyway. Why? Because in the event that she predeceases me, so I'm Yerusha. I inherit her. So therefore, there's a chance that I could get it from her. So if he uses it during the course of the marriage, and the marriage did not terminate in a divorce, and they're not there, so then he doesn't have to reimburse her. For even for the nechsei malug. Okay, certainly a little bit trickier in terms of understanding, but that's the. But in other words, by the Mema'enis, this distinction of Shmuel does not work out. Shmuel made a distinction that when it comes to Nechsei Malug, that she forfeits. When it comes to Nechsei Tzaron Bazel, that she doesn't forfeit. But in the case of the Mema'enis, if the clothing are there, she gets them. If the clothing is not there, she doesn't get them. So let's go. Okay, moving on now to the second woman described in the Mishnah. So the Gemara says, Ella Ailanis. Okay, so it's not talking about the Mema'enis, it's talking about the Ailanis. Okay, we jump from 1 to 3 in the Mishnah. Obviously, the reason why is because 2 is going to be the right answer. But the Gemara just wants to share with us why 1 is not the right answer and why 3 is not the right answer. So Ella Ailanis, so it's going on the Ailanis. So the Gemara says, this new I divide you shakla. So once again, an Ailanis, what does that mean? She walked into a marriage, she knew she was an Ailanis, she knew she couldn't have children,
She's a minor.
Two different cases. It's not the same case. It's just, in other words, she's an adult woman who the Gemara elsewhere tells us that there are telltale signs that a woman knows that she's an Islandist. So she went into the marriage and she didn't disclose this information to her husband. So the Gemara says like this. Now wait a second. If the clothing are still around, so obviously they go to her. Now over here she didn't disclose, and certainly that's not right. But nothing is prohibitive about this marriage. It was a mekach tos, but nothing was prohibitive. So therefore, there's no reason to give her a knas. All the clothing should go to her. And he delays no ibchamibaile. Now let's say it's the reverse. Let's say the clothing are not here. And so now it's a question of reimbursement. So the Gemara says, now, had it not been for the statement to Shmuel, the conclusion would have been just the opposite. Meaning, here's an island, she's walking away from a marriage, she brought in two sets of clothing, Nechzei Malug clothing, Nechzei Tzaron Bazel clothing. The Nechzei Malug clothing, that's hers. So she walks away with it. The Nechzei Tzaron Bazel clothing, the lav berishusa kaima, that's not a rishus. Because remember, Nechzei Tzaron Bazel transfers over to the husband, and the husband commits himself to reimbursing that at the time of divorce. But over here, there was no divorce, because it was a mekach tos. It wasn't a marriage. And so therefore, leisla. Therefore, that she doesn't get. Again, we're talking about a scenario where the clothing were worn down, clothing are no longer there, so he doesn't have to reimburse her. So, what we don't understand right now is the statement of Shmuel. Shmuel says that, in the Mishnah, we're describing her forfeiting her belows. So Shmuel says she's forfeiting her Nechzei Tzaron Bazel. She's not forfeiting her Nechzei Malug. So, I'm sorry, other way around. She's forfeiting her Nechzei Malug. She's not forfeiting her Nechzei Tzaron Bazel. Now, as we went through the case of the Mema'enis and the case of the Islandist, doesn't work out. So Ela Shnia. So the Gemara says we're talking about the Shnia. The Kansar Rabbanu Lidida B'Didei. Ulididei B'Dida. So the Gemara says, and why doesn't she get her Nechzei Malug? Now we're going to understand Shmuel. Shmuel says she's not going to get her Nechzei Malug because that's a kenas. That's a penalty. Meaning that was a marriage that was illicit from the very beginning. They engaged in illicit activity. The marriage does work, unlike regular arayos where the marriage doesn't even work. Over here, the marriage works. They're violating rabbinic law in order to get married. So the chachamim said, the chachamim gave a kenas, and part of the kenas is that which should have gone to her, i.e., her nechzei malug, is not going to go to her. The nechzei tzaron barzel, on the other hand, which if it doesn't exist, should have been enjoyed by him, and he shouldn't have had to reimburse her, but. Again, the Chachamim gave a knas in such a relationship. So now, finally, the only case that Shmuel is really describing is the case of the Shnia. Amar Shimei Barashi Shmami Namin Derav Kahana. So the Gemara says, okay, based on our analysis that we just gave, so we're going to draw the following conclusion. Ayla Glima Karna. I'm sorry, Ayla Le Glima. Let's say she brings a cloak into the marriage. Karna Havei. So the cloak is considered Karen. And therefore the husband should not wear it until it wears down. So the Gemara says, this goes against what we saw earlier. What we saw earlier in the Mesach is that when she brings in clothing, the clothing is analogous to the karka, and the wearing of the clothing is analogous to the peros. But now the Gemara points out, doesn't seem to be that way. And meanwhile, Va'amar Rav Nachman, the Gemara quotes the Gemara we saw earlier. Va'amar Rav Nachman, Peira Have. So the Gemara says to Rav Nachman, Pliga. The Gemara says, yeah, you're right. No, that's a good point. Meaning that Rav Kahana and Rav Nachman disagree in terms of how to view a clothing and the usage of the clothing. So according to Rav Nachman, the clothing is Karen. The usage of the clothing is considered peros. And so, therefore, husband is allowed to eat the peros of his wife's property. Over here, in the realm of clothing, the way we are categorizing it, he's allowed to wear the clothing of his wife. That's within his right. Meanwhile, according to Rav Kahana, doesn't seem to be that way. Because Rav Kahana says that if the clothing were in existence, the clothing would go back to her. But meanwhile, according to Rav Nachman, he was totally within his right to make usages of that clothing. So Rav Nachman and Rav Kahana seem to disagree on this point. Okay. Adkan, the Gemara takes it on now. Ein lan ksuva, the Gemara quotes the Mishnah. The Mishnah says that there's a forfeiture of the ksuva. Amish moloshanu alamanim asayim. Yes, in all three of these cases described in the Mishnah, so they are going to be losing manim asayim, the base amount of the ksuva. Aval tosefes yeshla, but yeshla hen. But if there's a tosefes, they're going to get tosefes. Now, it's interesting. Earlier in the Masechta, we said that tosefes basically takes on the identity of the base amount. Meaning tosefes ksuva is considered like ksuva. And the Gemara went through many applications of this principle that Tosefes Ksuva is considered like the Ksuva itself. But over here, though, there's a distinction. Here, in the case where a woman is forfeiting her Ksuva, Mion, Shnia, or Islandist, she doesn't get her base amount, but if there was a Tosefes that was added, that she's going to get. Tanya Namehachi, the Gemara quotes a Braisa. Nashon Shamru Chachamim Eilam Ksuva Kagona, Memenos Vechavrasam. So, a maman is together with all of her other friends. So, it's true they don't get the base amount of 100 or 200. Aval tosefes, yesh lahem. But they do get a tosefes. They do get that, whatever additional was committed to by the husband. Nashim shamru chachamim yotzei shelo b'ksuva kagon. Over sadas v'chavroseha. However, let's say that the marriage is terminated because of her behavior. Right? Over sadas. Right? The Mishnah we saw back in 9 days. Mishnah described a woman who was violating Torah and also aiding and abetting her husband to violate the Torah, or a woman who is not sanua. In other words, her behavior is she doesn't comply with Das Moshe, Das Yehudis, so her behavior is such that she forfeits her ksuva. In that case, not only is it going to be a forfeiture of her ksuva, ein lan tosefes v'kol shekein manim asayim. It's a full forfeiture of her ksuva. She loses tosefes as well. Okay, so even though there are a number of women that will be described in our Masechta that will be forfeiting her ksuva, but a distinction is made between the marriage where the marriage itself is prohibited, but her behavior was fine, so there she only forfeits her base, as opposed to the Mishnah is back on the Mishnah on the Ein base, where it's their behavior, there's a full forfeiture of all of her ksuva, both the base and the supplemental amount as well. No, tell us mashal afana v'yotza. Let's say she leaves as an account of shemra. Rashi, she was mezana. A woman committed adultery, so that also will be the conclusion of the marriage. So what does she do? She takes that which is in front of her and she leaves. Mesayla the ravuna, dam ravuna, zinsa lo hifsidi beloseha. The clothing that she brought into the marriage, that she does not lose. In other words, any clothing that she brought in that she still has, that she's allowed to leave. So the okay, top of Kuf Aleph Amud Beis. Tanitana Kamed Rav Nachman Zinsa Yisida Belosea Kayamim. So the Gemara quotes a Braisa in front of Rav Nachman, and this Braisa says that if a woman's mezana, she commits adultery, so she loses her clothing. The clothing that she brought into the marriage, she loses. Now that goes diametrically opposed to what we just saw back on the bottom of the previous Amud. The Gemara quoting the name of Rav Huna, that she does not lose her clothing. The marriage will conclude, he'll divorce her, she'll forfeit her ksuva, but she doesn't lose her clothing. And meanwhile, the Gemara is quoting a Braisa in front of Rav Nachman, the Braisa says she loses even her clothing. I understand she was mezana, but not her clothing. Okay, a sharp way of Rav Nachman basically saying, no, she's not going to lose her clothing. So, Tani, lo hifsida belosea kayamim. So Rav Nachman tells the Amara in front of him, that Braisa that you're saying it incorrectly. The next time you say that Braisa, the way to correctly say teach the Brice is lo hifsida below sekayam. Amar of Rachanam Rav Yochanan Zudiv Rav Menachem Stimasa. Gemara proposes another suggestion. The Brice may in fact be correct, but the Brice belongs to one anonymous opinion. Ava Chachamim Omrim Zinsa lo hifsida below sekayam. But the Chachamim say no, that if she was Mizana, she doesn't lose her clothing that's in front of her. Okay, so it's just another way of dealing with the same issue, and that is Rav Huna's psak seems to be the correct psak, that a woman who is mezana, she does forfeit a ksuva, but not the clothing she brought into the marriage. Im mitzchila nas'a. Am Rav Huna. Now, the Mishnah taught us that the islandess, before getting married, discloses to her husband, I'm an islandess. So under those circumstances, he's mekabel. So that, okay, so the marriage is going to be a fine marriage, and there's not going to be any forfeiture of iksuva. He knew exactly what he's going to get into. And moreover, in other words, a marriage is a marriage. So Am Rav Huna islandess, isha ve'ena isha. As it relates to the island, she's a woman, she's a wife, she's not a wife. Amana Isha Gemura, as opposed to an Amana, who's an Isha Gemura. Okay, what is going on over here? Meaning, what is the Gemara describing as being an Isha, the Ein Isha? So the Gemara is going to explain. The island is Isha Vein Isha. The Gemara goes on to explain that when it comes to an island, is she's a wife and she's not a wife. So hikar by yesh laksuva, lo hikar by in laksuva. Meaning it depends on whether or not the husband knew. If the husband knew that she was a islandess when he married her, it's fine, she gets a ksuva. And if he didn't know, it's mekach tos. Now, almana isha gemura ben hikar ba ben lo hikar ba. Now, as it relates to the almana, now it's interesting. Rashi over here says, it's so funny. Without Rashi, I could have suggested a pshat, which is she just didn't tell the husband she was a widow, meaning she didn't disclose that very basic information. Okay, but Rashi says, but that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about was a almana to a Kohen Gadol. Okay, a very obviously very limited application of this halacha, but the almana is marrying a Kohen Gadol, and so for any other Jew out there, she would have been perfectly legitimate. However, Torah prohibits a Kohen Gadol from marrying an almana. She didn't disclose this information to the Kohen Gadol. So right now what the Gemara is suggesting is, almana isha gemura ben hikar ba ben lo hikar ba. As it relates to the almana, so the Kohen Gadol is married to her, whether or not she did or did not disclose that information. Okay. So, yesh la ksuva. And therefore, she's entitled to a ksuva. Rav Yehuda omer, achazu v'achazu isha v'ein isha. And Rav Yehuda says, no, what are you talking about? No, of course not. Meaning, if she disclosed that she was an almana, and the Kohen Gadol says, okay, that's fine, I don't care. That's, you know, again, unbelievable that the spiritual leader of the Jewish people it's perfectly fine with the idea that, okay, I know you're an almana, but it's okay. But during Baisheni, we already went over a number of times, it's conceivable.
Is it still being pulled from
Shnias? I mean, no, this is not a Shnia, meaning she's an almana. This is a blatant violation of the Torah. So, okay. So and as far as Shnias are concerned, I don't know. My guess would be they don't, but... So achazu v'achazu isha v'ein isha. So hikar ba yesh laksuva, lo hikar ba in laksuva. Okay. So Rav Huna says that under both circumstances, for the islandess, for the almana, islandess for any man, almana for the Kohen Gadol, if there was disclosure, and he marries her anyway, she has a ksuva. And if there wasn't disclosure, so then there was no ksuva. So meisvei kata bechaska she came and nimsa she came yesh la ksuva. So the Gemara quotes a brisa. Brisa describes that he marries her, knowing that she was who she was. In other words, she was fully open and forthright about the fact that she was an almana. So good. So then, under those circumstances, he shouldn't have married her. Obviously, he's violating the Torah by doing so. But he totally understood what he was doing, and therefore, he marries her, and she's going to get a ksuva. So the Gemara says, now, what if she doesn't say that she was an almana? So it seems pretty clear from the Braitha that under those circumstances, she will be forfeiting her ksuva. So lo tema astama in laksuva, ela ema, kansa becheska she'ena kain, vidimsi she'ena in laksuva. So the Gemara says, well, maybe the diak we're making in the Braitha is not right, and maybe the real truth is that only if she lies, meaning there are three choices over here. Either she made full disclosure, A, B, she said nothing, or C, she lied. So maybe the only time that she's going to forfeit her ksuva is when she lied. So the Gemara says, so now what are you telling me? That if it was B, if she was neutral, meaning she really was a widow, she didn't say anything. She let him assume that she wasn't a widow. So you want to tell me now that she doesn't forfeit her ksuva? So the Gemara says, listen, ad ni becheska she came in him, says she came, yesh la ksuva, lishmin and stana, v'kol shekein. Ha. So first of all, come on, that's not how brises work. The brise is there to provide for us the biggest chiddush. If the halacha really were that a non-disclosure is not a forfeiture of a ksuva, the brisa should have said that, because that really is the bigger chiddush. And then obviously, full disclosure and acceptance of full disclosure, obviously obviously she doesn't lose her ksuva. V'o tani, kansa biyadu of an imseis biyadu yesh la ksuva. Kansa stam ein la ksuva. And on top of that, I'm going to take out another brisa. And this brisa says that a non-disclosure, not that she lied, but simple non-disclosure is going to be a forfeiture of iksuva, tiyufta de Rav Huna tiyufta. So the Gemara points out, good. So, I mean, good. Rav Huna's position is an untenable position. It's one that is refuted by the Braisa. To which the Gemara says, now, let's not kick a man while he's down, meaning what led Rav Huna to his conclusion. So the Gemara goes on to describe Rav Huna, masnisen ati asay. It's the Mishnah that misled Rav Huna. Why? Because sever me dekam maflik ba'ilan is v'lo kam maflik ba'amana. Because the Mishnah, look back at our Mishnah. Our Mishnah made a distinction between an islandess who discloses versus an islandess who does not disclose. Islandess who does not disclose, she doesn't lose her ksuva. Islandess that does disclose, she doesn't lose her ksuva. Islandess that does not disclose, so she does lose her ksuva. That's what the Mishnah taught us. So what Rav Huna thought is, good, now that I learned that distinction, but why did the Mishnah only give us that distinction as it relates to an islandess? So Rav Huna thought, oh, I know why. It must be that it only refers to the islandess. So that's what he thought. So who suffered midi kamaflik ba'alans v'kalo kamaflik ba'amana mechlal da'amana afilu v'stam anami? It must be that no distinction exists by an amana v'lohi. But the Gemara says, but that's not true. Meaning that now that we learned this halacha as it relates to the islandess, so good, it's true by all other women as well. Meaning if there was a point, it was an incredibly basic point that needed to be disclosed and it wasn't disclosed, so the halacha is that that's a mekach taos, and therefore there's not going to be a ksuva because, quite frankly, there wasn't a marriage. Okay, Hajjal HaKhaman and Izonis, that is the end of the 11th perek. Very good. So the conclusion of the women, the Mamanis, the Shni, and the Elnis, who are at the termination of their marriage, are going to be forfeiting their ksuva, and many of the details that revolve around that halacha. Okay, we start now the 12th parak. We are almost in the home stretch of the Masechta. 13 prakim to go altogether. Second day of Shavuos, I believe we're going to be concluding this Masechta. The first Mishnah of the 12th parak describes the following scenario. I know, say Isha, man marries a woman, and this is not her first marriage. She has children going into the second marriage. Okay, so that means that these children to this man are his stepchildren. I mean, that's how we describe it here in English. So is he by Tanai Ksuva obligated to support his stepchildren? The answer is no. But through Tanai Ksuva, he's not. Through Tanai Ksuva, obviously, he's obligated to support his wife, and he's obligated to support his own biological children, but according to the strict letter of the law, he's not obligated, he's not financially obligated to support his stepchildren. But, in other words, he really likes this woman, and understands that she wants not only herself to be supported by her children, just to be supported, so they contract. And the prenuptial agreement between the husband and wife is, says the Mishnah, I know it's Isha Upaski Imo, Kideshiazon is Bita Chameshanim. You know what? I pledge, more than pledge. I mean, it's a commitment, it's an obligation. I mean, that's what a pledge is, but just speaking stronger language. Right? In other words, I'm committing myself to supporting your daughter for the next 5 years. So Chayav Lazon, Chameshanim. So as per his commitment, so he's obligated to support her for 5 years. So far, this Mishnah sounds elementary. It sounds really basic, as we'll see in just a moment, where the scenario that's going to be constructed is going to turn this Mishnah into a big chiddush. Nisas la'achim. Okay, this marriage doesn't work out, now she goes and marries now another man. So for those counting at home, that this would be her third husband. So the and upaski mo kadeshiazon is bita chamishanim. And once again, her daughter is still very young, and so once again, she would like a financial commitment to supporting the daughter. And the husband says, sure, I'm going to support your daughter for the next 5 years. Chayav lazona chamesh shanim. So now he's obligated to support his daughter for the next 5 years. Now, we're going to assume that the second husband married her within the first 5 years of the first husband. So now, this stepdaughter has two streams of revenue. One coming from her former stepfather, and one coming from her current stepfather. Lo yomar rishon lecheshetavo etzli azona. So the first stepfather should say, could make the following argument. You know, this is strange. And I'm being nice in my choice of language. This is strange. She's now getting support. Meaning, isn't the whole purpose of my commitment to make sure that she doesn't starve? Not a problem. Right? She, my ex-wife, now moved on to another husband. And the other husband is financially committed to support her. So can I now make the argument that I have no financial commitment to support her? So the Mishnah says he has no right to do that. Meaning his commitment to support her is a financial obligation. And like any financial obligation, you're obligated. It's not, no, it is totally, it's totally independent. It is an independent commitment that he made. It was, he didn't attach it to the wife. Stay tuned, as the Mishnah itself will provide that out. But right now, it's an independent commitment. So Ella, just one second. Let's just get through the Mishnah. Ella molech la mizonosel la makom ima. So what the first stepfather has to do, the former stepfather has to do, is that he has to send her the food. Send her the food wherever the mom is. And maybe the two stepfathers will get together over dinner and they'll a little collusion. And they'll say, look, isn't the whole point to support her? So how about this? I'll pay half, you pay half. Right. The Mishnah says, no, you can't do that as well. So rather, the Mishnah says that what you're going to have to do is that the current stepfather is going to give her food, and the former stepfather is going to give her the value, in other words, money, equivalent to the amount of the food. Okay. Nises, now, let's go one step further. Now, let's say this girl gets married, okay? All within the time that she's currently receiving two streams of revenue for her food. Okay, I know this Mishnah is a soap opera, I understand. And habal nosen la mizonos. Vehein nosen la demei mizonos. Now, God bless her, she's going to have three streams of revenue. She'll have the two streams of revenue from the commitments of her previous stepfather and her current stepfather. And on top of that, she also has a husband. And we know the husband is contractually obligated through the ksuva to have to support her. Meisu, benosem nizonos minichasim b'nechorim, vehi nizonos minichasim b'mnei mishubadim. Now, in the event that her stepfather or fathers die, so their own biological daughter, everyone ready for this? Their own biological daughter will be collecting mizonos, but only from food that is, I'm sorry, only from money that is currently held within the estate. Vihi, but our girl that we've been discussing since the beginning of the Mishnah, now she's a stepdaughter, right? A former stepdaughter of the previous one, a current stepdaughter, but the truth of the matter is they're both dead now, so, right? Former for both of them, she will be able to collect her mizonos from them, even from nechasim mishubadim, even from encumbered properties, and for a very simple reason. Because mimnei shi kabbalas chov. Because when the husband made a commitment, a financial commitment, that is an obligation. That is tantamount to basically writing an IOU. It's a note. And the note of indebtedness incurs upon himself, not only for him to pay, but also for his property to pay as well. In other words, he wrote it. And he wrote it down, presumably. In other words, more than presumably. If he didn't write it, then there'd be no lien. So he wrote down this commitment. And so therefore, in the event that he dies, and we're still within the 5 years, so his obligation to pay her mizonos becomes so strong that there's a lien placed on his property to that obligation. And that's not true regarding his own biological daughters. Regarding his own biological daughters, so there is an obligation to feed them, but not... But no lien is placed. Now, do you remember why? Why is there no lien placed on the property to feed his own daughters? So we discussed earlier, we got to protect the buyers. Meaning because we don't know how long the daughters are going to eat. And so this is a variable. This is not a fixed. And you can imagine buying a piece of property. And now there's going to be a lien placed on the property against all future food that the children are going to eat. So then, you know, the economy is going to go to the tank. No one's going to buy property if you have that kind of exposure and there's no security in the property that you purchased. So therefore, there is no lien placed on the property. But over here, a 5-year commitment is a fixed obligation that he placed upon himself, contracting, writing to do so. That's something which is, that will be, there will be a lien on place on the property against that obligation. She, therefore, in the event that the estate has no longer any money to feed her, she can go after encumbered properties in order to collect that obligation where the biological daughters of this man couldn't do that. Okay. It's true by any Balchov. It's just the Mishnah over here is just using this as a, we're just, it's a sharp contrast, you know, describing the stepdaughter's ability to collect versus his own daughters to collect.
It doesn't matter if the biological daughters came before or after.
I mean, you know, ostensibly they're going to come after her because, you know, she's a stepdaughter, but no, it wouldn't matter. Okay, then the Mishnah just gives them one last line, and that is apichin ayukosim. So okay. So you want to avoid all this? And of course the answer is yes, you'd like to avoid all this. So then what the husband could just simply do, in other words, to avoid all of this, is place a very simple stipulation on the ksuva. Meaning, I'm going to support your daughter, my stepdaughter, but only in the event that we're married. Once this marriage terminates for whatever reason, I'm off the hook. I'm no longer obligated to support your daughter. So he attaches a very simple condition to this obligation, and that would avoid all of this.
If he dies, the same thing applies?
What do you mean? In other words, if this condition, kol zman she'ati mi, as long as we're together. So then, if they're not together for whatever reason, so then it doesn't, then the support ends. Itmar, okay.
The Mishnah says that this is the Rosh makes a good point. Bibneshu kibah shehi kibachol. She's not a real bachol, because of a real bachol, he can, the heirs, if she dies, the heirs will collect too. But here, she's not completely like
that. Okay. Oh, very good. Very good.
It's kibah.
Not the full status. Okay, very good. Itmar, we're going to turn our attention now to what seems to be an unrelated topic, but as you know the Gemara well enough, you'll know that we're going to go off track. But what's going to happen is that we're going to use our Mishnah to try to get back on track as a proof for the following discussion. Man goes over to his friend and says, I owe you a mana, I owe you $100. Okay. Rav Yochanan Amar Chayav Reish Lakish Amei Pater. Rav Yochanan says, okay, you've just committed yourself and now you're obligated to pay. And Reish Lakish says, no, you're not obligated to pay. At this point in time, we simply do not have sufficient information to fully understand what in the world is going on. Right? Right now, it seems so basic, so again, elementary, that I'm going over to somebody and I say, hey, I owe you money. And now the question is, do I owe you, do I not owe you? So right now it's just incomplete in terms of right in terms of understanding what's that issue. Hey chidami, which brings us to the next point of the Gemara. Idam luatame dai. So if let's say not only does he make a commitment, but also to that he turns to people that are surrounding, and they say that you are my witnesses. So and he designates two kosher witnesses to be witnesses. So good. So if that's what's going on, my time is Reish Lakish, the Kapater. So then I don't understand Reish Lakish, because now you've made a verbal obligation in front of two witnesses. You've even designated them as witnesses. You no longer can say at a later point in time, hey, I was just joking. Clearly you were serious. So then, obviously, you just made a commitment. And either lo amar lo atem edayin, if you didn't set aside witnesses, so my time to Rav Yochanan to come a chayev. So what would be behind the opinion of Rav Yochanan that you'd be chayev? So the Gemara says, at this point in time, all this seems to be pretty hazy. Like, what exactly are we talking about? Lo olam de lo kamar lo atem edayin. So the Gemara says, okay, so what's an issue over here is that he did not designate witnesses. So witnesses are not included in the scenario. So then what's going on? So what's going on? Says the Gemara. So what he says to the other person is that I'm obligated to pay you a mana through a shtar. Now, even at this point in time, it's not absolutely clear what the Gemara means over here. We're going to go with Rashi. Okay, Rashi gives a pshat. Other Rishonim give a different pshat, but for our purposes, we're going to stick just with Rashi for today. Rashi says as follows: Shemasa lo shtar b'fanenu b'kasav ani chayev l'chamana. So I'm sorry, v'afa pishik sav yadohu. Okay, he wrote a note of indebtedness over to the other party. And this is now, I could say this in the most literal way imaginable, this is an IOU. Literally, on a piece of paper he wrote, IOU. It's his handwriting, it's clear that it's handwriting, and Rashi points out, here's an important point to consider. V'lo chasam. I'm sorry. V'af ha'pishik sav yadohu ho v'lo chasam patar. Now, he didn't sign the bottom of the document. Now, remember, usually in a contract of obligation, a regular note, usually, it's not the borrower who's signing on the bottom, but usually it's the witnesses signing on the bottom, ratifying and testifying that this, in fact, that the creditor lent money to the borrower. Over here, however, he wrote a document and he didn't sign it. Just in case you weren't sure, I'm reading Rashi. Rashi reminds us, we learned earlier in the Masechta, that if you write a note and you sign the note, you, the borrower, sign the note, so you're going to be obligated. So and then there's nothing to talk about. That's clear. So utanan hotzi alav ksav yada v'chulei ama bechasim asyada kamari avahacha. So good. So if you signed your own IOU, so that's it. That's a real document. You're obligated. Now, by the way, that doesn't create a lien. The only document that creates a lien is only going to be a document that was signed by two witnesses. A document signed by you is not going to create a lien, but it will create an obligation. So any properties that are unencumbered, that are on your possession, so now the creditor can come and collect based on that IOU with the signature on the bottom. What makes our case unique and subject to a debate, says Rashi, is that you wrote it, but you didn't sign it. So avahacha achi kasav lachayv ani lachma never lo chasam ba. So this is what makes our case unique and subject to a debate between Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish. The note was handwritten, but it was not signed. Okay, and so now the Gemara says, now we're going to go over the two opinions. Rav Yochanan Amar Chayav, Alima Milsa Deshtara, Deshtara has enough force, it's Kimanda Amalu Atemedai Dami. It's like designating witnesses. In other words, what this piece of paper does is the following. The piece of paper by itself is not instrumental in terms of collection. It's not strong enough. But what it does is it gives a certain amount of seriousness to the proceeding. Meaning once you are handing over a piece of paper saying I owe you, and you're doing it in front of witnesses, and even if you didn't designate them as witnesses, but that piece of paper says that I'm serious. To the point where the witnesses, even though they weren't designated as witnesses, it's as if they were designated as witnesses. That's behind Rav Yochanan. Reish Lakish Amar Pater, Lo Alima Milsa Deshtara. And Reish Lakish says no. Meaning, if you want to sign the note yourself and give the note the force and power to collect, fine. If you want to set aside the witnesses, once again, that would be fine. But over here, you did neither. And the fact that you wrote a piece of paper saying I owe you, and even though you did in front of others, but you didn't sign it, so therefore it has no legal bearing whatsoever. Ad Khan, that takes us to the end of the machlokes between Reish Lakish and Rav Yochanan, and now we turn back. Now we go back to our Mishnah. Tanan anosei seisho paskei molazon es bita chameshanim chayev lazana chameshanim. So the Mishnah tells us that if a man obligates himself to support his stepdaughter for 5 years, he has to support her for 5 years. And really, there's a built-in question right now that the Gemara is asking, and that is, what's the point of the Mishnah? Now, again, we now went through the entire Mishnah. We know that there will be a huge point coming later, which is that the second stepfather has to feed her, and then her husband has to feed her, and now you have three streams of revenue. Well, that's true. But step one in the Mishnah is that he commits himself to obligate her to feed her for 5 years. And what does the Mishnah say? He's obligated to feed her for 5 years. Now, of course he's obligated. Meaning, that first point in the Mishnah is so basic and so elementary. Like, what's going on over here? So what the Gemara now is going to suggest is that there is a Chiddush in the Mishnah. We just got to look hard to find it. What's the Chiddush in the Mishnah? My love, ki I gavna. Oh, the Chiddush in the Mishnah is that although the stepfather made this commitment, he didn't put the commitment in writing. He didn't have witnesses signing it. Mm-hmm. He wrote on a piece of paper that I'm gonna support her. And maybe that's the Chiddush in the Mishnah. And that's a lot of speculation, understood. But if that's right, so then that would be a support for Rav Yochanan. To which the Gemara says, "Lo, bishtar psikta." The Gemara says, you want to know what the Chiddush in the Mishnah is? Chiddush in the Mishnah is shtar psikta. What does that mean? Rashi, chas, top of Kuf Beis Amud Aleph, chasim v'akala, poskin tanaim shebeneim, bishnei edim v'aedim chosmim edus gemura. What happens is as follows. The husband and wife get married. Nowadays, we write this, we kind of pretend like there's Tanaim, there are contractual agreements, but the Tanaim we do nowadays is a minug based on what was once upon a time that was done. What was done once upon a time? Once upon a time, two families got together, and the two families said, what are you putting into the marriage? Great. What are you putting into the marriage? Great. In other words, it's a financial contract between the two families. Okay, and when is it going to be ratified? How is it going to be ratified? The Chiddush. So Uched Rav Gidl. I'm Rav Gidl. I'm a Rav. Kama ata nosin levincha, kach v'kach. Kama ata nosin lebitcha, kach v'kach. Both families are now committing themselves to what they're going to put in. Amdu v'kidshu. The kids get married. Kanu. And kanu over here doesn't mean, and they make a separate kinyan, but the act of marriage itself is the kinyan. Hein hein adrama nikdim ba'amira. One of the rare instances where, even though we didn't do a kinyan seder, a chalip, and a signed document, in other words, we didn't do anything that is quote-unquote formal. The kids getting married, that is the formality that creates the kinyan. That could be the Chiddush in our Mishnah. Chiddush in our Mishnah is that he makes a commitment, and they get married, and that marriage ratifies that commitment. So that leaves us now out of the discussion of Reish Lakish and Rav Yochanan. Reish Lakish and Rav Yochanan is, although they're having a debate, and again, according to Rashi, the debate is about a note that went unsigned, a handwritten IOU that went unsigned. Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish debate that. Our Mishnah cannot be introduced into the discussion because our Mishnah is teaching us a whole separate Chiddush, and that is that the marriage itself creates a kinyan. Okay, Tashma. Kasav a Kohen Shani Chayev Lacham Ishlaim. So let's say a man writes to the Kohen the following. Okay, my son's the firstborn. I owe you 5 salaim. He writes on a piece of paper, I owe you 5 salaim. But he does not write on the piece of paper for what reason? So Chayev Litan Chayev Ishlaim. So now he made a commitment that he has to give the Kohen 5 salaim. Ubenoi Nepadui, and the son is not going to be redeemed. So the Gemara says, Shani Hasan de Meshubad Lamedaraisa. The Gemara says, wait a second. Over there, do you know why he's obligated to give the Kohen 5 salaim? Because the Torah says that any time a man has a firstborn son, he's obligated to give the Kohen 5 salaim. So the Gemara says, okay, so if the Torah says so, what was the point of writing it down? So the Gemara says, oh, because he wants to select which Kohen it is. So then now let's ask a really simple and fantastic question. So now, he paid the Kohen his money. He wrote a note beforehand saying that he was going to pay the Kohen the money. He did exactly what he was supposed to do. And meanwhile, his son is not redeemed. What's going on? So Ula says that, of course, when he hands over the money from the strict letter of the law, his son is going to be redeemed. And yet, the Chachamim stepped in, and the Chachamim blocked the pigeon. For what reason? Because what's going to happen is as follows. In this particular scenario, he actually paid money to redeem his son. But before he did that, he handed a shtar over to the Kohen. The observer over there, that pigeon of Ben, is going to say, oh, you know what we saw? So fascinating. I saw somebody give a Kohen a note in order to satisfy. Now, not having seen the money being transferred, so his conclusion is going to be as follows. Do you know what he must have given the Kohen? He must have passed on a note to him. In other words, he had a bond, and so bond obviously is worth money, not intrinsically, but still, the bond is worth money. And so what he did is he passed it over to the Kohen, and he said to the Kohen, look, here's my... Right, you'll collect. Yeah, and that'll be my satisfaction. You might have thought that such a thing works as after having attended that pigeon of Ben, not realizing that, no, the father just wrote a note saying that you're going to be my Kohen, and he actually gave him money. And so that's why in that scenario, the Chachamim were worried that if this were to happen, people will erroneously conclude that the note is good enough to satisfy the satisfy the obligation, and it's exerts a cost of that notes don't work. In other words, you have to give something with intrinsic value. Okay, we finished today the 11th parak of the Masechta. Went through the various scenarios of women forfeiting the ksuva for various reasons. We started the new parak. New parak talked about a man committing himself to support his stepdaughter. The Mishnah resulted in a scenario in which a girl had three different streams of revenue in order of being able to collect her mizonos. And then the Mishnah at the end said, you can avoid all that by throwing a condition into this contract. And then we are in the middle today, and we'll finish up tomorrow, machlokes between Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish, as to what would be the case of a man writing an IOU to another, no witnesses, no signed document, just a handwritten note saying IOU. He himself didn't sign the note. Is he going to be committed to pay him? That's the machlokes between Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish. And right now we're in the middle of trying to prove one side or the other.